Hi Fern, how are you?
Hey, Martin, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Doing good.
Good. And how are you doing on the Isle of Britain?
Very well. It's always a good day when you're English.
Okay.
So
That's a good one for
tell me about
Pardon?
your weather, Martin. Tell me about your weather just now.
Today's been actually quite pleasant. I've got to say, other days haven't been, but it's been rather damp and wet, but I suspect well, you're in Mississippi, aren't you? So have you had any of the hit from the tropical storm?
No, right now it's about 70, and so if it does come, it will be coming later on. It's not today.
It's been a bit damp and wet over the last few days, but you know, you're English, you just smile about it and you just get on with it and you just think, yeah,
And you
it's a
just
bit
go
damp.
on. That's like, what the heck?
Yeah, what the
Why?
heck? It's rain. What can I, you know, I can't change the weather.
Right. Honestly, might as well enjoy it.
Exactly. There's no
Yeah,
point
go
getting wound
swim,
up
do
on
something like that. And that's the best time to swim, when it's
it.
raining.
Yeah. Swimming. Yeah, not a big fan of swimming. It's like Justin and I have faces for radio. I don't have a body for swimming.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, if you
So,
swim and exercise, you can get a body for that.
there you go.
I exercise regularly. It, you know. Unfortunately, I think age is catching up with me. I think that's the shocking truth. I suspect.
Okie
I
dokie.
suspect. Speaking of age, I've got a question for you guys. Now, all three of us, we're old enough to remember the Cold War, and in today's world, anybody under 30, you know, for them, it's a chapter in their history book, or it's a movie in their DVD collection. So, what do you guys think about what's going on in Russia right now?
Well, I'll tell you what I think. Did you read the Whore of Babylon by Donny Debray? Have you read that, Justin?
I don't think so. I know that we've talked about it several times.
Okay. Well, she brought it up that the Cold War was never over. It was just in a hiatus, and it was going to come back. And she's been contending that for about the last 4 or 5 years. And when the situation happened with Georgia and Russia, she said, "Well, now didn't I tell you, Fern, with her deep Southern accent?" She said, "I told you it wasn't over with. It's just a form of, you know, a shell game." I said, "Oh, it's like wizard's chess. Now you see it, and now you don't." She said, "That's the truth." And so, if that is being true, and then Putin is playing the power game of not allowing Georgia to then ally with NATO, what's his ultimate goal?
What do you think, Martin?
Well, I mean, I suspect his goal is A, to protect Russia. I mean, I actually saw something on AboveTopSecret.com, and someone had posted a couple of threads about the fact that the Russian administration has made some interesting threats to Poland. Now they've signed that missile agreement with the states. You know, and I have to suspect that that has to be saber rattling because an attack on one member of NATO is deemed by all other members of NATO to be attack on NATO. And somehow I just don't think that, you know, Russia is crazy enough to decide to take on the whole of NATO. I mean, you'd have to think maybe in the Cold War era it might have been an option, but you think the Russian military is not what it was when it had, you know, all the Baltic states, when it had Georgia and it had all the
Well, they
Eastern
had about
Asian
15
states.
states. They had about
Exactly.
15 states, and so with the when the disestablishment of the former USSR, what happened with those weapon systems that were in those states? Were they then taken out to the boondocks, or do those nation states still have them?
Well, I suspect those nation states still haven't. I mean, Georgia is the Georgian military isn't exactly a sort of, you know, second-rate Mickey Mouse military. If you look at, you know, the history of Russia and particularly Stalin, I mean, Stalin was a Georgian, so you know, for many years Georgia was probably a fairly integral part of the USSR, and the Georgian military is by no, you know, is by no means a sort of third world military. It had a lot of, you know, some of the most sophisticated hardware that the Soviet Union had ever produced and developed. You know, I suspect what happened in Georgia is purely maybe size and the fact that you've got two forces that have been trained and indoctrinated in similar ways coming together with each other. And so they probably knew each other's tactics. And I suspect it came down to potentially, I think, maybe more modern equipment, probably some more tactical, better tactical minds, and probably superiority in numbers. And the fact that, you know, if the Russian military is to attack Georgia, it knows what the missile defense system, the air defense system is. So it can probably work out, well, hang on a minute, it's our air defense system. We should know how to break, or we should know how to get through our own air defense systems. I know that the Americans...
In the whole process of what's being established in that part of the world, how is that going to play out with the Middle East and with the oil lines that are going to from Russia through Georgia on down in Eurasia and also into Europe? How is that going to affect?
I suspect some people think that could be part of the reason why Russia is flexing. My suspicion, I think, is that Russia is flexing because it feels hemmed in and surrounded. And I've got to say, I took some of these ideas came from a thread I'd seen on AboveTopSecret.com. But if you actually have a look at what's happened more recently with Russia, you think that, you know, you've got South Korea, you've got Japan on one edge of the Soviet Union. You've potentially got Alaska on one edge as well. And then you start to come down round and you've got a lot of the, you know, the old, what they call is the Stan states. Most of those seem to be currently fairly well disposed to the West, so to speak. Then you've got Afghanistan, then you've got Iraq, and then you've got the old Soviet client states who are now moving much more to NATO. I suspect that a lot of this could be fear on behalf of the Russian government and the Russian administration, as they're feeling very hemmed in, you know, and they are thinking, well, hang on a minute, this is just like the Cold War, as you said, Fern, but, you know, instead of us having maybe a buffer of, you know, other states, that wall is basically right on Russia's borders, rather than being, you know, Poland, East Germany, Yugoslavia, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Romania, and all those other satellite states.
Now, you know, it's also ironic, Justin, that this happened during the month of August. When you look at what happened in the First World War, and you call it's called the Guns of August, Ferdinand was assassinated.
Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated by Gabrielo Princip.
Well, don't you think it's ironic that, I mean, this is, what was it, 2008, and that's almost 100 years, that the same thing would be happening, because the war has just really been a continuation from the First World War, the Treaty of Versailles, and the Second World War, then the 20th century being the bloodiest century practically for 2,000 years. I mean, it's just a continuation.
And it shows me that people have forgotten their history, because in the coming weeks and months ahead, as the situation continues to play out, if something terribly unfortunate like the Archduke Ferdinand assassination were to occur, it could set off that whole powder keg all over again. And my best example would be if the Russians put a laser-guided bomb on the Georgian capital and they just happened to kill the Georgian president.
Oh, whoa.
Ouch. And I just can't see them doing that.
I can't either.
The sort of political ramifications. I mean, we have to consider that in other than potentially... name, you know, Georgia is, you know, starting to be, you know, is wanting to become a fairly, you know, an integral part of the NATO alliance. You know, I have to think that an attempt like that on a sovereign state, and Georgia is by no, you know, you've got to call it a sovereign state. You know, unfortunately, I think the US do have quite a murky water here, because, you know, the Russians can quite clearly turn around and say, but you went into Iraq, which was a sovereign state. So I suspect it's fairly murky waters here for the Americans to sort of stand up and try and hold the moral high ground. But I just don't see Russia wanting to up the ante so much.
Well, you know, one thing I can see what America could be doing is looking at the G8 and saying, okay, we'll go back to the G7, and you'll no longer be allowed to participate in that. And how would that affect the rise of the so-called democracy capitalistic system in Russia?
And I suspect that's probably a fairly, you know, fairly serious thought process that's certainly going on there. I mean, you know, from an economic point of view, you know, I've always been curious as to why you've put Russia in that way. I mean, it hasn't exactly got, you know, a huge economy. It's not exactly, it's a growing, I think you'd call it a growing and emerging capitalist economy, but it still probably has huge overtones from the Soviet era. And I suspect the reason that they sort of expanded the G to include Russia was purely from a sort of geopolitical point of view here, rather than the fact that they've got a major economy that actually influences the rest of the world. I grant you, today with the huge natural oil and natural gas reserves and potentially coal and other raw materials that, you know, are in the Russian Federation, you know, they're probably a fairly major supplier of raw materials to the rest of the world. But, you know, just how influential is the Russian economy? I suspect it's not, but if you look around and think, well, actually, if you look at a communist state, I'd say that the Chinese economy is, you know, much more significant in global terms than, say, the Russian economy. And I'd even put, you know, you'd even have to think, I mean, I think Italy's part of the G8, Canada's part of, I mean, those economies are probably much more developed and sophisticated than the Soviet, than the Russian economy.
Now, development, sophistication, and influence are three different things. One thing that Fern and I have talked about many times in the past is the fact that Russia is currently such a major supplier of gas and oil to the European Union countries that, you know, if they decided to turn that stuff off, you guys would be in some pretty serious pain.
I suspect we'd have to, yes, we would have to think about things, but, you know, from an economic point of view, where else is Russia going to sell the stuff? I mean, if you think that Russia is trying to become a much more capitalistic economy and a much more mover and shaker in the world, it needs foreign currency to do that. If it all of a sudden said, right, we're going to switch that foreign currency off, you know, how many billions of euros, sterling and dollars does the Russian economy lose overnight by taking that plug off? I grant you, switching it off to, you know, ex-satellite states probably has very little to do with the, you know, balance of trade surpluses or deficits that the Russians may or may not have. But I just can't see them switching it off. There's just
What's their GDP? What's their gross domestic? Where are they ranging? I mean, are they at between with all the G8 other countries? Where do they are they last?
Golly, I've no idea, but I'll use the magic of the internet and see gross domestic product GDP and just see what it says. But
now, while you're looking that up, Martin, I've got another question to put you on the spot with here. This seems to be beat up on Martin Bain Day. So NATO has, in my opinion, become less of a military force and more of a bureaucracy. So if you're Vladimir Putin sitting there in Moscow, do you really fear NATO?
I think you have to, and I would disagree that it's become more of a bureaucratic machine. You know, a lot of what's going on in Afghanistan is, you know, fronted by NATO. You have to think that, you know, a lot of NATO forces are significantly combat ready and combat trained. So if you are Vladimir Putin, you've got to be thinking, okay, how many of my soldiers and my forces are as combat ready? I mean, you have to think. And that's another reason why I don't think that the Russians would actually want to do anything. Because if you look around and think, well, the US and the UK, France, and some other countries, you know, our military are constantly in combat. They're constantly combat ready and combat trained. You know, is the Russian army, which is still substantially a conscript army, is, you know, does Vladimir Putin really want to put that up against, you know, a combat ready, a combat seasoned, very effective military machine? And in certain areas, the Russian military probably do have some advantages over NATO. But, you know, I suspect in pure technology terms, NATO still has, and the Western allies still probably have a more technology orientated military. I think the Soviet Union, or sorry, Russia, is catching up, but I suspect they would still be trying to think, do numbers make a difference against technology?
Well, then you also have to look at, too, you might want to think about, is that if their technologies have not kept up within the last, since 1989, due to restructuring and perestroika and Mikhail Gorbachev and all the things that happened after that period, then they shouldn't be at the same level as America and the UK. And if that's true, then what would their alternative be? There would be nuclear weapons, nuclear warfare.
Yeah, and I have to think that, you know, we've managed to keep the balance of, you know, the balance of power and not destroy the planet, you know, in the height of the, you know, I don't know whether you call it the old Cold War, the first Cold War, or whatever here. I mean, I just can't see how, you know, a serious political leader like Mr. Putin would countenance, you know, potential fairly serious annihilation of the planet over something like Georgia, over like something like oil supplies. Now, I'd like to think that these guys have sort of, you know, matured and become slightly more rounded human beings and realize that, yes, I don't really want to have my finger on that button, but, you know, I live on this planet as well. Because, yeah, it doesn't matter if, say, for example, you know, Russia or China decided to do that, it's lights out for the planet. I mean, there's no getting away from it here. Great. So, you know, they managed to land some serious hits on NATO, but it's still 4 to 8 minutes, and we see that up. So what do? We just launch everything we've got. And all that's happened is, you know, it's just a wasteland out there with a few people. I just can't see Russia doing that. I can't even see it getting involved in some kind of, you know, direct skirmish with NATO. I suspect that we may see some more instances like what's happened in Georgia, you know, where they flex their muscles. There's no way I can see that Russia will touch Poland. Not a chance, because as I've said, they touch Poland, the rest of NATO is duty bound under the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Mm-hmm. That and an unprovoked attack on Poland is an unprovoked attack on every other member of NATO, and they would be honor bound. Otherwise,
okay,
the whole NATO.
Look what happened in the Second World War. Where did Hitler, what was his first, when Chamberlain came to him, Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, where was the first place that Adolf Hitler?
I suppose we can always argue about this one. I thought it was the Sudetenlands, but I suppose technically it was Poland, I think, was probably one of the first places.
I think Fern is thinking Austria and the Anschluss?
No, I'm thinking of Poland.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
I know it's totally different and everything like that, but in the DNA of what's going on in that part of the hemisphere of the world is that and this time of the year, Putin is not going to allow Poland to have the capability to wipe Russia out with Star Wars.
But ultimately, I've got to turn around and say I don't think any of us are probably savvy with what this missile defense system is designed to do. And I suspect there is a public view of what this missile system is supposed to do. And then there's probably the and plus what else we could actually use it for. Now, you know, I've heard that it's designed to prevent a missile attack from a rogue nation somewhere either in the Middle East or Far East, and that the system is supposed to be able to take the missiles down. But I suspect there must be more to it. And the fact that they've put it in Poland, okay, you have to think there's some obvious geographic reasons here, but I suspect there are also some political reasons as to why they placed it in Poland. I think, interestingly, if you read some of what Poland has negotiated back for allowing the US to do this one, they're going to be getting, you know, several batteries of Patriot missiles, which I think is slightly more interesting as to hang on a minute, not only is Poland going to be getting the benefits from the missile defense system, but they've negotiated as part of the agreement to have some Patriot batteries.
Please
continue your thought.
No, you go on.
Okay, now, my question here is, you're both talking about political and diplomatic stuff. The number one thing I see here that concerns me is that the Russians have historically had no shortage of political will when it comes to this kind of thing. And as proof, I would cite that in Georgia right now, I was looking at news feeds earlier today, and they're still pulling the same stunt where they're saying, we're going to leave. But yet Russian mechanized units continue to drive further into the country. And what that demonstrates to me is that Moscow has political will that the Western powers currently don't have.
And you know, that tenacity of their will, my little sojourn and living there for a month is that I got introduced to several people that worked in the Politburo at that time. And the thing that really amazed me is that the people themselves didn't want war. The people did not want to have another Second World War. And I'm sure a lot of people today can see the precariousness of their situation. And they don't want missiles flying into St. Petersburg and any of those places. They don't want that to happen. And so do their people have any more voice than the people of the UK or of Poland or of the United States? I mean, a lot of people here in the United States didn't want an invasion into Iraq, but what good did it do?
And I suspect that, that's a very astute assessment, Fern, in that, it goes back to a lot of things that, Justin and I have discussed on some of the shows about, political representation. And I know it's something that people talk about on AboveTopSecret.com about, are our political leaders actually interested in listening to us, and are they interested in furthering us as a people? Because you have to say, well, what does Russia gain by, invading Georgia? I suspect one of the things it gains is that it sends a message to some of the smaller states on its borders that, unless you're part of another big boys club like NATO, we will flex our political muscles. We will flex our economic muscle here. We will use reasons to ensure that that you've got to keep us on our good books here. And I suspect that I think is a lot of it, is that Russia's now seen an opportunity. The US, his eyes are off the ball. The US morally cannot really criticize what Russia has done in Georgia.
It's exactly. Funny you should mention that, because in the last week you've had John McCain, who unfortunately spoke those words that the Russians can't go around invading other sovereign nations. And then within 72 hours of that, Mitt Romney, a vice presidential hopeful, he said virtually the same thing word for word. And, both of you, I think, are on the right track there. Any time an American politician says that at this time, it does make them look rather silly, regardless of party affiliation.
Exactly.
It's even the same, even from a UK perspective, there is no way that the UK can sort of morally, with all gusto and forcefulness say, hang on, Russia, we don't think this is the right thing, because they'll just turn around and go, let's think about this a little bit, shall we? Let's look at the map, shall we, Mr. Brown? Oh, look. Let's look at Afghanistan. Let's look at Iraq. And you're absolutely right. I suppose the only thing that potentially John McCain has going for him is to say, he can turn around and say, okay, I'm not the president of the United States yet. I suspect he voted in favor of going into action in Iraq. So, I think on this issue, potentially Senator McCain is somewhat morally bankrupt to be able to have the gall to stand up anywhere and tell Russia that it's not appropriate to go out and invade another country. I'm not sure whether anybody, you know, some of the other candidates, both for president and for vice president, you know, they may have a better moral ground to actually stand up and say that if they chose not to vote in favor of going into Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, the one thing is, how about this coming, the 25th, the Democrat Party will be having its convention. And with all this going on in Russia, and also what's happening in the Middle East, and then not leaving out Venezuela and Cuba and things that's happening in Africa, this person that's going to be the president of the United States after this convention or after the election, well, look, what is he going to, or she, maybe, possibility, how are they going to be able to sit down at the table of reason and say, you know, Russia, you know, Putin, we need to sit down and talk and let's work this out and look at some of the things that we can do in building infrastructure and economics with the EU and other trading blocks. Do you think that either one of these candidates have that potential, has that capability?
Ah, that's a tough one, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I suppose if it, you know, if I sort of look at it from a looking in point of view,
Okay, let me jump in here while Martin has a chance to think. Yeah, no, you'd have to say that no matter who the next president is, regardless of what Russia's actions may be, the next president will have to spend their entire one or two terms in office just mending fence. Just. Did we lose somebody?
No.
There. Okay.
Martin, you still there?
I'll see if I can get him back.
Oh, okay.
But I think that the next president's just going to spend time mending fences.
Well, coming up here, Justin, while you're getting him, getting thoughts and for people to think is that Hillary Clinton, Senator Hillary Clinton, will be speaking Tuesday at the convention. Wednesday will be President Bill Clinton. I thought that if you are the preemptive candidate, that the convention really is sort of yours wrapped up. And what is it that with the Clintons that Senator Obama allowed them to have these two nights? Wasn't it supposed to be about, I mean, he's the first African-American that is possibly in the census countries has been that would be running for president and could be elected, and that he would be so open to allow the former president and his nemesis, Senator Hillary Clinton, to have two nights? That's quite amazing. Is there a hidden agenda here, or that is just because of his openness and creating something totally different? What do you say about that, Jeff?
I think there's two possibilities involved there. One is that, and the second is that this was just a necessary compromise. It was one that he had to make for the sake of party unity.
You think so?
It's possible. Hang on one sec here.
Shifting. Well, it's quite amazing through this whole process of, I mean, this, it seems like this has been going on for almost all 2.5 years, and we're now down to this is almost September, and so we've got September, October, and November the election, and the Clintons are still, you know, squeaking. I mean, they're putting oil on the wheel of the Democratic Party. And Senator Obama, he's not that farther ahead than Senator John McCain. And, you know, running, you would think he would be much further ahead, according to the polls. So what has been holding him back? Because he did really great when he went to had that trip, and he went to the Middle East, and then he also went to Afghanistan, and he went to Germany, did really great. But when he came back, it seemed like the bubble sort of busted. What do you think?
I think what happened was there's a series of continual rookie mistakes, and I think we just got Martin back.
Great.
Yes, technology, and I just caught a little bit of about Senator Obama doing his grand tour through Europe, which, you know, was he deliberately trying to sort of live up to the mantle of JFK? Because I have to say, you know, I wasn't alive when, you know, JFK came to Germany, so I can't comment on that. But, you know, there's, you know, looking at news reports and some of the things, you know, people seem to be making this parallel, which I'm not sure. I'm not sure how healthy and helpful that actually is for Barack Obama. I'm just not sure it's actually that good thing that people try and compare him to JFK. You know, and I listened to the speech he made in Berlin, and I have to turn around and think there was very little substance in my mind to it. It was just sort of, yeah, okay, I've got to do a world tour, I'll get some publicity, and maybe I'll make some of the people in the EU slightly happier that maybe having a Democratic president is better for them than having a Republican president.
Well, so, you know, from my point of view, as an American, what I see from the inside here is I think that he made the mistake of stepping on hallowed ground. I don't think people paid attention to what he said as much as they paid attention to the fact that he was essentially reenacting a moment that is sacred. It's canonized in American history. And so when his critics did come after him for that event, they said, hey, look, you know, everything he said in this speech, word for word, line for line, is nothing new. He said this stuff everywhere else. It just seems like he was trying to go to a historically sacred place in the hopes that that some of the mojo would rub off on him. And in an earlier show, Martin and I were talking about the fact that if other politicians tried to do that, if any politician had tried to go to the Brandenburg Gate where Reagan gave his famous speech, or even if they just tried to use any other sacred locations as a backdrop, if Gordon Brown had made any kind of political statement at all out in front of Chequers there in England, he'd be done.
Okay, let's put it conversely. Say Gordon Brown coming to the Lincoln Monument and trying to do a speech like Martin Luther King.
Ooh, I can hear the knives sharpening now.
I was going to say, Fern, if you want Gordon Brown to come over and do those kind of speeches, don't feel embarrassed. Ask away.
Okay.
He might be looking for a job here real soon.
No, that's I'm sure is a totally another discussion point. But yeah, certainly I think it is interesting that I think, and you touched on it, Justin, is that, you know, Senator Obama has made some rookie mistakes here, which says to me, well, has he got the right people around him? If, you know, why is he making these rookie mistakes? Because you have to think, you know, that, you know, he's now in the driving seat potentially for the Democratic nomination. Surely you'd like to think that the Democratic Party might have, you know, molded around him a little bit and said, you know, if there were seen or perceived weaknesses in some of the people on his campaign staff, that might have been solved or reinforced. And to make those mistakes says, you know, is he making the right decisions about who's in his campaign team?
Oh, hey, Fern, Martin was off the air for a moment, so would you put the Clinton question to him?
Would I put a question to him?
The Clinton question.
Clinton question.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you perceive the Clintons, and, you know, the convention starts on the 25th. On Tuesday, Hillary Clinton will be speaking, which will be her night. Wednesday, President Bill Clinton will be speaking. If you were Senator Barack Obama, would you allow that to happen? Here you are, you know, the first African American that's going to be most likely to be the candidate for the Democrat Party to run for the presidency of the United States. Would you allow your nemesis to have a night and her husband, the president of the United States, have a night? Or are you just so magnanimous that you would say, okay, we know what you've done for our party and our country, and I'll just allow that to happen? Or would you say, hey, if I can't stand up to them, how am I going to be able to stand up to Putin?
I think that's some very interesting points there. I suppose I'd split things up a little bit here, Fern, and say I think I would separate the fact that Hillary Clinton was going to speak and Bill Clinton were going to speak. Yeah, you know, I suspect that, you know, Bill Clinton, you know, when he left office, you know, still had some incredibly high public ratings, even though he may have done some things that, you know, looking back, people might say, hey, you shouldn't have done those. And I suspect if he could have stood for another term, the American people may well have elected him for maybe at least one more term. And if he had not done anything stupid, could potentially have even elected him for a term after that. And I think it would be disingenuous of the Democratic Party to not give the last Democratic president the opportunity to speak and rally the troops, because, yeah, as I think we all suspect here, that, you know, Barack Obama will be given the nomination. The influence and pull that someone like Bill Clinton actually has to, you know, making sure that the Democratic machine works properly, and that, you know, some of those wavering voters do think, hang on a minute, yeah, Bill Clinton did a fairly good job, and there's somebody who's in the same party as him, and Bill's popped up and said, actually, this is the best guy for the job now. You know, I suspect that has a lot of mileage and kudos. The other one about, you know, getting Hillary to speak. Yeah, I mean, again, you know, I think that maybe the party is looking here to say, how do we bring the party together, and maybe giving Hillary the opportunity to speak to say, yes, it was an acrimonious discussion. There were maybe things said and done on both sides that, looking back, we shouldn't have done them, but we were both passionate. We both believed that we were the right person to be president of the United States. But, you know, now the party has spoken. And now I'm now going to put all my weight behind Barack Obama becoming president of the United States. Again, I see that as maybe more of the Democratic Party being clever to say, we have to bring the party together, because there's nothing worse than, you know, a fractured party. You know, the opposition could just drive a wedge through it.
Ah, but what about the potential for a palace coup?
Because she just suspended her campaign. She didn't, you know, stop it. Per se.
Yeah, and, you know, and I've no idea what the feeling in the States is about that one. In the UK, we probably don't get a lot of press, particularly about, you know, whether Hillary Clinton now stands a chance of being president. I think there is an acceptance in a lot of the media in the UK that, you know, it will be a runoff between, you know, a 70-plus-year-old Republican man and a 40-year-old African-American male. I don't think anyone here has seriously put an article forward saying that, you know, Hillary Clinton's going to come in and, just as Barack Obama's about to pick the trophy up, she's going to come and whip it away and say, aha, gotcha. I don't know what the view in the States is as to whether, you know, that's going to happen.
But could she force him to give her the vice presidency, whether she hates him or not?
I think she could. I think because what the party has done to support them, to have each one have their own night, I think they could force that to happen. When do you think the announcement will be? Will it be before the Olympics is over, or during the first or second night of the convention?
I think if they don't announce at some point during the convention, well, I mean, obviously they're going to have to announce during the convention, but I think that they're probably going to hold off until the day before, and since that's the start is the 25th, then that's not too many days away.
And interestingly, you start to take, you know, you can start to spin conspiracy theories here. You know, hey, you know this. This show will end up on AboveTopSecret.com, so I might as well throw it out there. If we take what you've said, that, you know, Hillary Clinton is, you know, the vice presidential candidate, and I have heard people say that, you know, Barack Obama may not survive very long being president, because, you know, there are still probably people in the States that do not want an African American as president. You know, absolutely, it's not a question of, is he the right man or not? It's purely, unfortunately, a race issue. It would beg the question, you know, if Hillary Clinton has worked herself to be vice president, is she maybe thinking two things? Is Barack Obama going to maybe run for more than one term? she may be thinking, okay, if I can do a good job as vice president, then I stand a good chance of being, you know, the obvious candidate for what would be 2012, won't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other one
and what
is
would her age be?
But I have to turn around and say, why is age an issue? You know, why should it be an issue if somebody is the right person for the job? It doesn't matter whether they're 18 or whether they're 80.
Uh-huh.
I've got to say, I'm trying to, you know, get over, you know, in many, you know, and I have to say, you know, the UK did have a, you know, we probably weren't the most, you know, open country for older people. But as our population ages, you know, I don't have a problem. If the person is 18 and can do the job, the person is 80 and can do the job. I don't really care. And I think electorate care less about that. They care more about, well, can I trust this person? Yes or no? And then, you know, it doesn't matter about it. But the other thing I was going for, you know, is Hillary Clinton, or have some of her advisors thought, well, hang on a minute, you know, Barack Obama, because he is an African American, there are going to be people in the States who will no doubt be saying, God darn, you know, if the man's elected, I'm going to make it my mission to make sure that he goes 6 foot under incredibly quickly. There are people who will be thinking and saying and very well maybe planning for that eventuality, more than potentially if Hillary Clinton was elected or John McCain was elected. So is she thinking maybe Barack Obama is going to be a much more higher profile target, and potentially someone might get him if he dies? Who is next in line to be president?
Well, you know, in reference to saying that, what she mentioned in the latter part of May in reference to Bobby Kennedy and his assassination, and which happened in June in the 60s, you know, that could still be in the backdrop of her mind, her mindset. And those are realities that are facing Senator Obama, that that there are people out there that think like that.
So now, for what it's worth here, just to put my two cents on the table for this discussion, I don't actually think she's going to be his vice president, but I do think she's going to go back to the Senate. I do think she's going to be the Senate majority leader. She'll find a way to get Harry Reid's job, and then she will go out of her way to put the knife in him that way so that he is just a one-term president. And for the record, she just turned 60. She'll be 64 in 2012.
But interestingly, and both of you can answer this one, I thought on the succession of presidency, it goes president, vice president, and then isn't it something to do with the senior party representative in Congress or something is then next in line?
Speaker of the House, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and then, ta-da, what do you know, it's the Senate Majority Leader.
So is Hillary Clinton going to go for Speaker?
Oh no, she won't take the pay cut, and she doesn't want Nancy Pelosi's job, and by all reports they can't stand each other anyway.
And
so you know,
what we're looking at totally is a very bombastic, exciting time, not only in the United States but the UK and throughout the world. And what are you reading, Martin, over there in your press in reference to if he was elected president of the United States?
Good question. Good question.
It is a good question, and I was just sort of pausing for a minute to see. I've got to say, I've not seen a great deal of people starting to analyze what may change if Barack Obama is elected. Yeah, on a global scale, I can't see that things are going to change that much. You know, he may have a better relationship with, you know, Gordon Brown because, you know, the Democrats and the Liberal Party, sorry, the Labour Party are probably seen, you know, being politically closer. But, you know, I suspect that that's less of an issue. I think the real big issue is how is Barack Obama going to, you know, what is he going to do around foreign policy? I suspect is going to be more interesting. And is he going to, you know, look more into the US and be maybe not, you know, totally isolationist, but maybe think, hang on, I've got to put the US first as the US rather than the US as currently the world policeman and the person that goes around enforcing what is perceived to be right and wrong. You know, I suspect that Barack Obama is going to have some horrendous and fairly serious issues to contend with inside the continental USA, you know, and as well as all these side issues of, well, what do I do in Afghanistan? What do I do in Iraq? What do I do with Russia? What do I do with NATO? What do I do with Georgia? You know, potentially he's looking at a fairly dire economic situation in the States. You know, people are going to be electing him and expecting, because he's a Democrat, and maybe because he has tried to say, well, you know, or people have made the analogy between, you know, what Barack Obama does and JFK, you know, are they expecting some kind of miracle because they're electing somebody who some people think, oh, hang on a minute, there's some parallels here to John F. Kennedy, you know, and is he going to get a horrendous, you know, is he just going to get a horrendous thumping because economically and politically he's just not going to be able to deliver on, you know, making things better for people?
Well, all I can say is that in my lifetime, I have, because I've come from a mixed family, similar to Barack Obama's, that there are different drums that beat for you. And if it's your Irish family, for myself, man, if I hear an Irish priest, boy, oh, my ears just perk up, you know, and everything. But that is the makeup of a lot of people in the United States, but they only can identify with their African roots, you know, and through the period of slavery, et cetera, and stuff like that. But there's other dimensions that work with families like myself, is that we have the Native American. My family was, mother's side was Blackfoot. And like the Today Show I did today was on your grandmother's, how she would take care of you when you were sick. And I think about how we have to go back and get our different types of roots and to take care of us and everything. So there's a lot of dynamics, social dynamics and economic dynamics, not only with the different minority groups that are in America, but the ship has been sinking a little bit. We don't want it to be the Titanic. And whoever's going to be elected, we want them to work in a world power, global community that everybody's not threatening each other with saber swords to annihilate each other.
And I have to turn around and say, you know, it would be nice to get world leaders that, you know, could actually think like that. I suspect they're not going to be, because, you know, they will have been elected, you know, off the back of people, you know, promising them things or bringing blocks of votes, maybe at the conventions. And then, you know, people will be saying, hang on a minute, I can give you this segment, I can give you that segment, but, you know, I want a job in government, or hang on a minute, I want this, I want that one, you know. And I don't know how you change the fact that, you know, it doesn't matter how righteous people see Barack Obama or John McCain here, you know, they will have got to the top job because other people will have been prepared to put their backing behind them. And, you know, it doesn't matter how sort of, you know, upfront we are and say, oh, I'm only doing it for the good of the nation. You know, I disagree with that. They're doing that because at some stage they're going to be expecting some kind of, you know, return on investment. Exactly. Absolutely here. So, you know, I can't see how.
You said it very euphemistically, but they were looking for a payoff.
The proof of all that in the United States in recent years has been the events leading up to and following Hurricane Katrina, which Fern can speak to much more directly than I can because she actually lives down there on the Gulf Coast.
And from the experience and bringing in other companies to repair parts of the Gulf and what is still left down there in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans is terrible. I mean, this is going to be 2005. This is 2008. This is the third year. They're having a big prayer vigil tomorrow, Saturday night, because the 29th is coming on up of Katrina, and there's so many people now. There's over 5,000 people moved to this county from the Gulf. So we have that impact, and we see it every day. But poor political decisions that were made not only at the local level, but at the state and the federal level, which happened. And it's still affecting so many thousands and thousands of people. And so whoever's going to get elected is going to have quite a job.
Absolutely. And I sort of look at, you know, what happened with, you know, Katrina, you know, yes, on a personal level, you know, some, you know, a catastrophe for, you know, many, many people and many families had their lives, you know, uprooted and ruined. But what I see is, you know, here is supposedly the greatest economy and the greatest country on the planet, yet, you know, it couldn't politically, or it couldn't militarily actually just wade in.
Ow!
People.
Militarily?
It could have, but it was forced to do it. And because it was forced to do it, a lot of people lost their lives and their income and things. Decisions that were made long time ago on those levees that caused a lot of the problems too.
I suspect that, but even if you can go back, and you know, I'm sure there are people who say, well, hang on a minute, that decision was wrong. But even if you say, starting from, you know, taking the, you know, the first time that someone worked out that, you know, potentially a fairly horrendous storm was going to hit the area and the levees might break and things might happen, you know, we all saw reports of people, you know, in the Louisiana Superdome and, you know, and all that kind of, you know, yet, you know, I look at it and say, hang on a minute, the US can transport, you know, thousands of tons of equipment every week halfway across the world to fight a war, yet potentially it cannot just turn a switch on and say, actually, hang on a minute, I just need to mobilize, you know, hundreds of thousands of lorries, hundreds of thousands of people, and I need to send them into Louisiana, I need to send them into New Orleans, I need to send them into Mississippi, I need to send them into the Gulf Coast, you know, almost in a military mindset, because I suspect that's what went wrong, is that they didn't have somebody who was there, you know, who said, right, I am ultimately in charge, I can issue orders, if you don't do it, I'll get rid of you. It seemed that there were too many political decisions here, rather than, you know, the military are given a job, you know, the commander-in-chief says, you need to do that, and it ripples down to the soldier on the ground who's told, you better go and blow that house up, because we need to get through it.
Who is the commander-in-chief?
I suspect George Bush, what, George Bush 43?
Ah.
But
that's the commander.
Could he have
FEMA.
And I'm just wondering, is, you know, and I think people, you know, I think people would be split on this one, whether FEMA helped the problem or exacerbated the problem. I look in from the outside and say, I suspect it was, it probably didn't do as much good as it was planned to do.
Well, I think there's been a lot of changes that have been corrected. Is that right, Justin?
Well, that's what they're telling us.
That's what they're telling us. Well, in California, when the fires burned in California, there was a much rapid, more response to what was happening. Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor, was able to get a much more rapid response from FEMA. Is this show just about over with?
We are prepared to wrap, as a matter of fact.
Prepared to wrap, huh?
Yeah. Anybody got any final remarks?
Well, the only thing I was going to go back to, and I have had this web window up for a while, just to show that, you know, when questions are asked on the show, we do it. You sort of spoke, I think, early on in our discussion, Sven, about the GDP, relevant GDP, and, you know, I'm going to take Wikipedia as its source, and then they've got three listed here for 2007. One is International Monetary Fund, one is the World Bank, and then one is this must be true, the CIA World Factbook. That must be true. I cannot conceive of that being wrong in any way, shape, or form.
Why would they lie?
I'm not supposed to laugh right now?
Yeah, you can laugh if you like. But interestingly, they sort of put the biggest... GDP is the States at number one. Russia is 11. And interestingly, all three of these things say that Russia is exceeded by Brazil, Canada, Spain, Italy, France, UK, China, Germany, Japan, and the States. So if you were to say, hang on a minute, so why aren't Spain...
Why are they in the G8?
Yeah, why aren't Spain in the G8? Why aren't Brazil in the G8? And why is Russia in the G8? You know, I think it was an interesting point that you actually raised. I think it goes absolutely back to the fact that, you know, Russia is such a vast country. Its, you know, influence that has come from what happened during the Soviet era is still so large that these guys maybe deemed it was a good idea to have, you know, one of the ex-world superpowers on board rather than them being, you know, outside of the G whatever it was. It's better to have them inside the G organization. And I suspect
So then the analysis would be then, okay, the only stick that I have is because I don't have a moral stick anymore, but we've been in the United States because we invaded a sovereign nation, is that then we could sort of force them to be out of the G8.
Absolutely. And you think of the G8, I think, is the US, Japan, Germany, UK, France, Italy, and Canada, I think. What are the G8 plus? Then Russia must be involved in that as well. And I think India were involved in that one. So, you know, you'd have to think that all of those countries could probably get together and say, guess what, when we have our next meeting, we're not going to invite Vladimir Putin. I suspect that's not going to happen. I suspect they will continue to have a dialogue with Vladimir Putin, and I suspect they need to continue to have a dialogue with Vladimir Putin, and they probably need to start seriously thinking about, do we want to put China into this equation as well? Because looking at all these statistics I've got, China is the fourth largest economy in the world.
Right, and you know what? What is being considered right now? You mentioned Brazil. What are they? What was their GDP? They're number what now?
They're 10. They have $1.3 trillion. Is it $1.3 trillion?
It's ironic that no one in South America, Central America, are involved. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, you know, maybe this is an opportunity for Fern to say that, you know, you're going to stand for presidency of the United States in 2012.
Hey, look, y'all have a great day. I love Mississippi. Okay.
Hey.